But I want to begin by suggesting a slight change of subject. We need to understand that not all targeted killings are taking place with the use of drones. And I believe that the deep issue here, I mean, I know the technology is important, and the bishop put the two things together, the targeted killings and the drones. We also need to consider the use of death squads on the ground. The killing of Osama bin Laden, for example, did not involve the use of drone technology, and in some of the countries that have the capacity for weaponized drone technology, some of them also use squads of men on the ground to carry out what are effectively assassinations. So respectfully, I submit that we bear in mind that targeted killing is the deeper category and the one that we need to focus on. There's a good definition of it in a book by Nils Melzer called Targeted Killing in International Law. Lawyers love definitions. He said, it's the use of lethal force attributable to a subject of international law, that's what we used to call a state, attributable to a state, with the intent, premeditation, and deliberation to kill individually selected persons who are not in the physical custody of those targeting them. And it seems to me the crucial thing there, and the thing that it would be good to focus on resolutely for at least part of this weekend, is the business of deliberately and with premeditation focusing on a named, identified individual, singling them out, putting their name by presidential order on a death list, and then ordering either troops or machines to carry out that death sentence, if we could call it that, at a time and place of our choosing. Targeted killing, in that sense, is what I think we need to think about. In December 2005, the Supreme Court of Israel, sitting as the High Court of Justice, considered the Israeli government's policy of preventative strikes aimed at killing members of terrorist organizations in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, even when the people being targeted were not actively or immediately or imminently involved in terrorist activities. The court confronted the claim made by a number of people that, by a number of plaintiffs and petitioners, that this was a violation of Israeli law, international law, the basic principles of morality and human rights. The petitioners were an Israeli human rights group, Palestinian human rights group, and they argued that the members of terrorist organizations were criminal and should be dealt with by way of arrest and trial, and only killed if that were imminently and immediately necessary for self-defense. I much appreciated the bishop's comments on how the definition of imminence is being expanded to adapt to the technology. Anyway, the suggestion was that this needed to be challenged. In a long and very thoughtful opinion, President Emeritus of the Court, Aaron Barak, very distinguished jurist, rejected the absolutism of that contention. He argued that there were circumstances in which targeted killings were permissible. He argued that people who had engaged and intended to engage in terrorist activities had the status of unlawful combatants, and one couldn't rule out the right of the Israeli Defense Force to use force against them, even when they were not actually engaged in combat. He said, the revolving door phenomenon, by which each terrorist has the horns of the altar to grasp or a city of refuge to flee to which he turns in order to rest and prepare while they grant him immunity from attack, is to be avoided. But Justice Barak said very thoughtfully, these cases are to be approached on a case-by-case basis. How regular is the target's participation in terrorist attack? To what extent is his retreat back into civilian life just an opportunity for rest and preparation? Is the mandated alternative of arrest and trial, which is crucially the first line of defense, available in the circumstances, and what is the liable collateral cost in terms of loss of life for civilians who are not unlawful combatants? Now, I'm not interested today in discussing the legality or wisdom of this tentative set of conclusions that President Barak came up with. I'm a great admirer of him and his jurisprudence. I think the decision is a sound one. This evening, what I am interested in is something that Barak said in the course of his opinion as a sort of a reminder of what was at stake. He acknowledged that the state's fight against terrorism is the fight of the state against its enemies, and that Israel had suffered a terrible cost in the innocent lives of its own people as a result of thousands of terrorist attacks directed against it. But then he said this: "Needless to say, unlawful combatants are not beyond the law. They are not outlaws. God created them as well in his image." God created them as well in his image. Bishop Pates mentioned the same saying, obviously the clear reference to the Genesis saying of God, "Let us make man in our image after our likeness. In the image of God he created them, male and female created he them." It's a reference, secondly, to the Noahide laws given after the flood, a reminder in the context of the law of homicide that in the image of God made he man. But here's my question. Why did Barak think that was important to put that in the midst of his judgment as one of the key premises on which he was going to proceed? I doubt that an American court would ever say this in its decisions about unlawful combatant status. Though there was a time when our judges did talk in these terms, a time when Justice McLean could say in his dissent about the petitioner in Dred Scott, in the Dred Scott and Sanford case in 1856, when he could say that the petitioner bears the impress of his maker and is destined to an endless existence. He is not a mere chattel. We used to talk like that in our courtrooms. Israeli courts are not afflicted, I don't think, with the Rawlsian doctrines of public reason that our philosophers put about, which are intended to limit the citation of religious considerations in public life. But there's still a question of what this reference is doing there and what it adds to the argument that Justice Barak was making. Barak didn't just say that the terrorist suspect is entitled to legal protection, to the protection of the laws, although he did say that. He didn't just say that the suspect was entitled to the benefits of human dignity, though he did say that. What he actually said was, "Needless to say, unlawful combatants are not beyond the law. They are not outlaws. God created them as well in his image. Their human dignity as well is to be honored. They as well enjoy and are entitled to protection by customary international law." Needless to say, he said, it may be necessary to put it in those terms to pull us up short. Yeah? To pull us up short, to remind us that although we are dealing with an outsider, a malefactor, an enemy of the state and the people, a threat to our lives and those of our loved ones, one who will maim and kill scores of innocent people if he gets the opportunity, although we are talking about someone who may be justly liable through his actions and intentions to force or even deadly force, we are nevertheless not just talking about a wild beast or a good animal gone bad. One of those wild, savage beasts, as John Locke put it, with whom man can have no society or security. We're not just talking about something that may be manipulated or battered or exploited as a mere tool for our own purposes. The terrorist may be a threat and an outsider, but he is also man created in the image of God. I'm going to be impertinent for a moment, Rabbi, but Jewish rabbinical tradition.
I'm honored.
Has some sayings in the Mishnah, from very ancient sayings, concerning the way that witnesses were admonished in advance in capital cases. Witnesses were reminded, if they're giving evidence in a capital case, of what was at stake in a capital case. They were reminded that if someone was convicted as a result of false or equivocal testimony, an evil would be done that could not be remedied. So the passage reads, "In capital cases, both the blood of the man put to death and the blood of his descendants are on the witness's head until the end of time. Therefore was the first man, Adam, created alone to teach us that whoever destroys a single life, it is as if he destroyed the whole world." There's not another species of man that we are entitled to destroy. "And whoever saves a single life, it is as if he saved the entire world." Very well known. Element in the saying. "Furthermore, only one man, Adam, was created for the sake of peace among men, so that no one should say to his fellows, 'My father, my forefather was greater than yours.' Man was created to show the greatness of the Holy One, blessed be he. For if a man strikes many coins from one mold, they all resemble one another, but the King of Kings, the Holy One, blessed be he, made each man in the image of Adam, and yet not one of them resembles his fellows." This was an admonition put to witnesses in capital cases. It's a bit of a stretch, but But it's as though Justice Barak were reaching back to repeat something like that in his judgment, something like that traditional admonition. It's a way of reminding the court to proceed carefully in its arguments because this was in effect like a capital case, or at least it concerned in general terms the shedding of blood by the state. And if the court were wrongly to sanction this sort of assassination, it would, like a false witness, be taking upon itself the grave responsibility of having provided judicially for the destruction of sacred human life. So a proclamation that the individual we may be targeting, created in the image of God, serves as the basis of a compelling constraint. It doesn't dictate the outcome of the case. Yeah? But it means you're not to proceed carelessly or recklessly or with euphemisms like taking somebody out or neutralizing them. Yeah? We are to face up to what's directly at stake here, which is something that falls into the category of murder or uncomfortably close to murder. Whatever we say about targeted killing, we mustn't flinch from the fact that we're dealing in the realm of the taking of human life, and the deliberate, premeditated, and well-organized, focused killing of a named and known and identified human being. So I mentioned that case. I can give you a citation for those of you who like these things. The case is the Public Committee Against Torture in Israel against the Government of Israel, and it's December 2005. You could find it just by Googling any combination of those words. It's a remarkable, remarkable decision. So I'm counseling a steadfast focus on the taking of human life. Of course, we should be concerned about collateral damage. After all, that too would be murder, apart from the laws of war, and I'm not sure the laws of war actually cover these areas. If I blow up a house intending to kill X, and I know that Y and Z are in the house and I don't intend to kill them, that's murder according to most criminal codes. Lack of direct intention doesn't insulate it. Collateral damage is important. The killing of innocent civilians is important. And probably for making a success-oriented case, it will be important to emphasize that. But collateral damage is an issue here. It is not the issue here. The issue is targeted killing. Of course, we must worry about the killing of the innocent, but we must beware of the fallacy that a preoccupation with that legitimizes the premeditated killing of the guilty. The position of the Obama administration is that if terrorists and those who organize terrorist campaigns can be classed as combatants, then they are not protected and the killing or disabling of them may be privileged under international humanitarian law, that is the law of armed conflict. True, the selection of a target, the profiling and identification of an individual to be killed by name, by identity, differs from our usual image of combat, which is the killing of enemy soldiers in a large-scale, anonymous, impersonal way. Targeted killings being directed against selected individuals, they seem like the conceptual antithesis of what we have ordinarily understood as combat and what just war theories have ordinarily understood as combat. We have to ask ourselves, and I hope that Mary Ellen O'Connell and some others in the audience will be able to address this, whether that difference in conceptualization amounts to a moral difference. I mean, think of it this way. You're a major or a captain in an army unit, and you are about to undertake an assault upon a legitimate military target, a hill that's defended. And your colonel comes to you just before you jump off for the operation and says, there are only soldiers up there. Nothing but soldiers, there are no civilians. Those are your targets, and I want you to make sure that you kill the names on this list. Yeah? I want you to make sure you kill the individuals named on the list, all of whom we know are up there. Right? So whatever else goes on, kill these named individuals. Wouldn't the captain or the major feel there was something rum going on? Yeah? Why were they named? Was it because they were communists or Jews? Or dissidents, or would be embarrassments after the peace process, or whatever. So as well as doing the technicalities of the legal detail about whether the named targeting of people is a legitimate act of war. Just think a little bit about the underlying moral psychology of suddenly being told, okay, you're going to be conducting conventional armed operations, but I want you to make sure that you kill these named individuals, who are all legitimate targets, yeah, because they're under arms. But make sure you kill Colonel Smith and Captain Stein. Yeah? Make sure you kill these armed individuals. Harold Coe, former dean of Yale Law School, who was for a time the State Department's legal advisor, has astonished many people with his support for targeted killing. And he is adamant that the mere fact of naming and targeting identified individuals does not distinguish a killing from an act of war. There's all sorts of questions about whether these people are, in fact, combatants, but he's sure that the naming and targeting is not itself an issue. And I don't know the answer to this conundrum, but it doesn't seem like an act of war to me for the President and his National Security Council to be working with lists of names and to be moving names from one list to another and to be drawing up the death list, yeah, to be arguing whether this name should be there, and in effect, constitutionally or unconstitutionally, deciding by presidential decree that this individual shall be killed. This one here, we're not sure about yet, that individual shall be killed. Yeah? Sure, doesn't sound constitutional, doesn't sound legitimate to me. And it seems to me that we need to think a little bit about the spiritual and the moral dimensions of that feature of targeted killing. In a way, it's weird, what Bishop Pates referred to as signature strikes, where a drone hovering in an area decides to kill just people who fit a certain profile, maybe bearing arms, maybe being in an armed training camp. In a way, that's more like conventional military operations than the targeted killing when you go after somebody by photograph and name. Both are problematic, but I hope there'll be some time to focus on this issue. Of course, there are questions about the transparency and due process of maintaining these lists, and how can we be sure that the right names are on the list? Other people in the country will worry about this. I believe this group should take the opportunity to ask whether killings of this character should be countenanced at all, whether this is the sort of approach that should be taken to human life. I don't know the answer to these questions. I do think it changes the character of the killers. I think it changes the character of what the killers are doing. I'm a legal philosopher. I read Immanuel Kant for a living, for my sins. And in his 1797 book, The Metaphysics of Morals, the part of that book devoted to the right of nations, Kant wrote, "A state against which war is being waged," that allegedly is us, "is permitted to use any means of defense except those that would make its subjects unfit to be citizens." Means of defense that are not permitted include using its own subjects as assassins or poisoners, or snipers who lie in wait to ambush individuals. Yeah? Now, some of the reasons that Kant adduces for this position have to do with the longer-term prospects for peace. In his essay, Perpetual Peace, he says, "No nation at war with another shall permit such acts of war as shall make mutual trust impossible during some future time of peace." Mustn't use acts of war that will make mutual trust in the future, in time of peace, impossible. And again, he cited the use of assassins and poisoners as an example of that. But I think we should take seriously what he says in the earlier version. "Such stratagems make murderers of our intelligence operatives and soldiers." And whether the philosopher can make sense of it or not, whether the philosopher with his analytic toolkit, I know whereof I speak, can plumb the depths of ethos and honor and tradition and military psychology that make it possible for us to reconcile, at least in a just war context, people coming to terms with their having taken human lives. It's not clear that it's the same process when you're talking about taking out a file and pulling it out of its plastic cover and identifying the individual by name and looking at where they'll be and which weddings they'll be attending and so on, and then aiming at that particular individual. I think it's a different psychological process, and it may not be something which can as easily be come to terms with as some of those who talk carelessly about drone conflict say, I do think we need to think about the impact on character and virtue. Virtue here. In all of this, I've used some ugly and emotive language. I've talked about death lists, and I've talked about death squads, which is one of the reasons I didn't want it just to be about drones, although these are what, death machines. But death lists and death squads makes our national security apparatus sound sinister. Like, I don't know, a South American dictatorship. I make no apology for that. The ugly and sinister overtones are a salutary reminder that we might be seeing the emergence or re-emergence of an ugly and sinister form of state power. Lethal power now organized as assassination from the skies, untroubled by judicial process, untroubled by the normal traditions of armed conflict, giving an entirely new feel to the laws of war and perhaps also a new and brutal aspect to our criminal process as well, because you need to bear in mind, off to the side somewhere, that the use of drones for the enforcement of national security imperatives against terrorism is matched a little bit by its use in other wars, like the war against narcotics and so on. And we know we have concerns about the over-militarization of the police forces. Bear in mind that this is one possibility on that agenda as well. Churches in our society have always, and quite properly, taken a keen interest in the sword of state and the way it is wielded, and in the safeguards and discipline that are supposed to surround its use, mostly the rule of law, in the church's concerns also about capital punishment, and as the bishop reminded us, since Augustine, in the laws of just war, insisting that the concentration of lethal force, necessary no doubt, in the hands of the state is nevertheless something to be watched, and watched with great care, because we are aware that humans are not perfect, they're fallible, and these are likely to abuse. So if this is a new form of American statecraft we are seeing, a new way of dealing with those whom we define as our enemies, then we have reason to pay very careful attention to it at all. This is not just a good constitutional system gone bad. This may be the emergence of a new way of dealing with political and social difficulties, a new way of disposing all too easily of beings created in the image of God, our citizens, as the Alulaki example illustrates, placing them on a list for targeting, a list for elimination from the world. We face this as an American process. The bishop reminded us that there are 87 countries with the technology to weaponize drones if they should choose to do so. We know that the Israelis use this technology, the British, the Russians. Are we comfortable with this becoming a standard form of state and military activity, not just for the United States, but for other countries with whose bona fides we may be less comfortable? Are we comfortable that this might be a standard way of dealing with those whom we can designate as terrorists, which is not a term that's always used rigorously, not a term that's always used easily? We know the South African government condemned the African National Congress leaders as terrorists and tried to assassinate and succeeded in assassinating some of them. My friend Albie Sachs, now retired as a justice of the South African Constitutional Court, lost an arm and lost an eye in one of those attempted targeted killings. The British experience, I'm a New Zealander, I'm from British stock. The British experience, I apologize, is particularly sobering. As it clung to the remnants of empire, Britain faced insurgencies in Ireland, Palestine, Cyprus, Aden, India, Kenya, Malaya, I don't know where else, all over the world. And at one time or another, the British government denounced as terrorists those who emerged to become the leaders of those countries. Kenyatta, Makarios, you can think of the examples. The temptation to respond to insurgency by targeting people who could be described as terrorists, convincingly, or at least plausibly for public relations purposes, it would no doubt be irresistible if it were not for the presence of strong norms prohibiting assassination or anything like it. Yeah? Those strong norms, it seems to be a necessary accompaniment of our concern with the lethal nature of the sword of state. Humans are fallible, open to temptation. In politics and in the pursuit of national security, the stakes sometimes seem to be very high. The viability of national policy may be at stake, or innocent lives may be at stake, or the survival in office of not so innocent politicians. Politicians have to deal with things like insurgencies. An insurgency, whether it's justified or unjustified, may pose what seems to be a grave threat to values like public order, innocent lives, or, as I said, the survival in office of not so innocent politicians. And it may seem that sometimes it would be better to simply eliminate or take out, sorry, I can't now resist the story, and it's utterly inappropriate, but my stepdaughter came home from school once, and she said, "Mom, what does it mean when someone goes like this?" And Carol said, "Well, what do you mean? What was the example?" And she said, "The teacher was talking about Jesus Christ, our blessed Savior." I'm sorry, there's no justification whatever for a joke at this part of my peroration, but politicians have to deal with these threats, and it may sometimes seem that it would be better to simply eliminate or take out, as we sometimes say when we're trying to appear hard but still don't want to use the word murder, some of those who are leading the insurgency or posing this risk to the life of the nation. Better to do that than to continue risking the values that the government stands for. Such a tactic may seem less costly and more decisive than what can be achieved through the scrupulous, uncertain and long drawn out procedures of ordinary law enforcement, or less costly and more decisive than what can be purchased in the uncertain currency of compromise, negotiation and the addressing of underlying grievances and so on. Assassinating one's enemies or those who can be designated as enemies of society is and always has been one of the standing temptations of politics and government. If it has been held at bay in the practice of advanced democracies over the past 100 years, it has been held at bay only partially and uncertainly through fragile structures of law, ethics, and humanity that inform our image of what a state is like and what needs to be justified when we think about state action. I believe we need to think very seriously about what it will be like to live in a world where those restraints are unraveling, because that is the direction, it seems to me, in which American leadership in this practice of targeted killing seems to be taking us. Thank you very much indeed.